hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
It's often been said that election officials were the heroes of the 2020 election. Facing unprecedented attacks on the election system and a global pandemic, they managed to pull off an impressive feat, a secure election with the most voters ever. Election officials are a vital part of the administration of an election. It's a year-round job as they prepare for upcoming elections, audit previous ones, and make sure it all goes smoothly. The Elections Group is an organization that helps to support election officials, offering resources and support to better professionalize the role. Jennifer Morrell is the CEO and co-founder of the Elections Group. She also served as an election official herself. Jennifer, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with your prior role as an election official. You helped to run elections in both Utah and Colorado. What was the biggest thing you learned in these roles?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say in Utah, I learned that great ideas and best practices only go so far when you have inadequate resources. And by that, I mean not enough people, not enough space, not enough equipment, not enough money to carry out those plans. I was really fortunate in my move to Colorado, not just to experience being in a jurisdiction that was slightly better resourced when it came to people and space and financial resources, but my big takeaway in Colorado was really the power of strong state associations. The opportunity to share and implement best practices was incredible. There was a real sort of collaboration that I hadn't seen in other places, certainly hadn't seen in Utah, where ultimately it led to better uniformity of practice across counties so that a voter would have a very similar experience regardless of the county that they voted in. And as part of that collaboration and power of that strong state association, we really had an active voice in legislation, meaning there was actually an opportunity for election officials to come to the table shoulder to shoulder and affect real change.
So what's amazing to me about your response there, I guess two things. One, if you talk to election experts, they'll often point to Colorado and in some ways Utah as sort of gold standards for how to run elections, or at least states that are doing it a lot better than others. And yet you still experienced a lack of resources in those places.
So that was a very long time ago. Utah has came leaps and bounds since I left there in late 2014, early 2015. So I certainly don't want to disparage the work that they're doing now. But I bring it up as a point that when I'm out in the field and I'm working with jurisdictions that have struggles with resources, those are real challenges that even the best practices sometimes can't fix.
Yeah, but also, you know, you said that was a really long time ago for Utah, but, you know, it also shows you can improve things in a relatively short time, right? You know, in a decade, Utah has become one of the better states in terms of its election administration. The other thing you said was the power and importance of strong organizations for election officials. And since, you know, I'm recording this from Kentucky, I thought I'd point out that the Kentucky Clerks Association, I think, is seen as one of the better organizations to help professionalize the field. And I think it's no surprise that often Kentucky is looked at as another national model for doing things right, even though I think we still have too restrictive voting laws in many ways. The work on the ground of the officials, I think, is considered really good. So you started the Elections Group in 2020. Let's talk a little bit about what that organization is and what it does.
Sure. So the organization started really because of COVID. We saw a need across the country as jurisdictions of all sizes were trying to scale up their mail and absentee ballot processes. That was something I did successfully in Colorado, but it took years of sort of learning from my peers, learning from my colleagues, and adapting good practices. We were looking for a way not just to tap into our own expertise, but to work, pull those best practices, those standard operating procedures from election offices across the country that we knew were doing a really great job, and distill those into checklists, into guidance documents that we could quickly share out with those jurisdictions that were going in some places from 10% of their voters voting by mail to now suddenly 50, 60, 70%. And as a result of that, the elections group was sort of born, or we realized that there was an opportunity there. Today, we have over 20 members of our team. We provide all sorts of resources free, most of them free, to election, state and local election offices across the country. Everything from procedure documents, how to do things like ballot proofing or logic and accuracy testing, to communication resources, to thought leadership in things like post-election audits. We conduct trainings. We do presentations at clerks conferences. We try to engage with state associations like the amazing folks here in Kentucky. So we really see ourselves as a unique shop focused on best practices in election administration.
And one of the things that underscores is that being an election official is a year-round job. I think sometimes the public thinks that, you know, the election officials are just basically getting ready for an election and that's their busy season and that's it. But it is really a year-round job as you're, you know, preparing for the next one and checking back at the previous one. You mentioned post-election audits, and I know that's one area of your expertise, what's known as risk-limiting audits. So tell us a little bit, what are risk-limiting audits? How many states are using them, and why is it a best practice?
We'll start with hopefully a simple definition. A risk-limiting audit is a type of post-election tabulation audit, and it gives us statistical assurance that the voting hardware and software produce the correct winners. And we do that, or we perform that audit, by having humans examine a randomly selected sample of voted ballots. So we don't look at every single ballot, but we take a selected sample and we compare the voter markings or the votes to the results reported by the voting system. And this often looks like a hand count. So that sample of ballots may be hand counted. And then we're going to compare the outcome of that hand count to what was reported by the voting system. The audit's really looking for statistical assurance that the outcome of the election or the outcome of those audited contests are correct, that the voting equipment interpreted all of those marks made by voters correctly and assigned those votes to the respective candidates correctly and aggregated those votes correctly. So it's one way that we can feel confident that if those audited contests are correct, then the other contests on the ballot are also correct. One thing I like to add is that, because I think often people think, well, RLAs are new, they're complicated, where did they come from? They're actually developed from acceptance sampling, which was used for quality assurance in munitions factories during World War II. So they're not necessarily a new idea. It's just an old idea repackaged, but they have been slow to catch on. We have four states, Colorado, Nevada, Rhode Island, and Virginia, that by law require a mandate that RLAs are done after every election. But there are also other states. I think there are like nine other states that either have an option to do an RLA or are conducting some sort of pilot program or will be implementing RLAs here in the near future.
Yeah, I think it is 13 that are doing RLAs or risk-limiting audits now. So how can we get other states to join the party?
Maybe
that's a big question and something you're
teaching,
working on a lot about, obviously.
Educating on RLAs for over 5 years now. I think the thing is risk-limiting audits do require a high degree of ballot organization and accounting that can initially feel overwhelming. That's why I really encourage states that are interested to do a pilot, similar to what Kentucky did last year. It's a way that state and local officials can understand the needs of of their system, their way of organizing, cataloging ballots to do this type of audit. I think it can be challenging to explain to voters. So I tried to give you a simple explanation, probably could to boil it down even simpler than that. But when we think about some of the mathematical formulas that are used to determine what is an adequate sample size, that can be challenging to explain to voters in a way that they can feel confident about that. So that has been certainly a hurdle or a challenge. I think there are some states that are still doing what we refer to as a traditional audit, where they may sample a certain percentage of voting equipment or precincts or ballots, and they feel that audit is adequate. It's meeting the needs of those states. The one thing we are encouraging and would really like to see is national adoption of some standards, regardless of the method that's being used. There are two audit reports on our website. I won't spend any more time talking about them, but if anyone listening is interested in election audits, especially tabulation audits, I'd encourage you to look at both of those.
And the public education component is so important. And I think the underlying, maybe simplified message here is that elections are looked at in a routine manner. It's a very routine thing to go back and take a look at the previous election and ensure everything was done correctly. That's a normal routine part of the job of an election official. And of course, being an election official requires a lot of training for lots of different sorts of activities, and your organization is working to create training programs, professionalized training programs for election officials. I know you've partnered with universities in a handful of states or working on some other states. Tell us a little bit about those efforts.
Sure. So this is a project we're actually partnering with the Bipartisan Policy Center on. I think everybody sees the value of currently serving election administrators, having access to training and information, but also spaces where they can collaborate, where they can share best practices, share challenges. But especially as we look over the last few years and the amount of turnover that we've seen in states, the number of individuals coming in, either new to that leadership position or even just new to the election office itself, we recognize that there's a real need for creating training programs that lead to some sort of certification, not just to ensure that the election official knows their job or the staff that are working with them know how to do their job correctly, but also as a way of retaining people. Training certification can go a long ways in helping people want to stay in that position and stay committed to the work that they're doing. So our effort is to both help states think about what is needed long-term in owning and administering a training and certification program, and then also helping to build that training, whether that's in-person training done in a class around things like processing provisional ballots or thinking about ballot reconciliation and chain of custody, or managing poll workers or voting sites, or ensuring that ADA standards and compliance have been met. There's so many things that go into running a successful election. So the number of training opportunities and classes and courses to create is really limitless. We try to work with states to identify a small starting group there, build those, and hopefully eventually build out that program.
And of course, we're talking about election officials, but poll workers need training as well. Talk a little bit about the best practices for training poll workers. You know, I wrote this article a handful of years ago called A Checklist Manifesto for Election Day, and it looked at poll working training guides. And I was kind of shocked at how long some of them were, which made them really, I think, in my view, difficult to use. Tell us a little bit about the best practices for poll worker training guides, poll worker training, and what can states do better?
I did take a look at the checklist manifesto report that you wrote. I need the checklist or the shortened version, but I promise to go back and read that in depth. But I think you're spot on. What I saw is what I've seen in practice seems to mirror some of the things that you identified in your report. And that is, we have these volunteers, they come in for just a few hours, and we throw all of this material at them. And not only is that not effective in any sort of teaching or training, but certainly isn't effective for folks that we expect to perform these jobs with absolute accuracy and no mistakes on election day. I think where we've seen success is jurisdictions, one, that do spend a little more time than just an hour or two. In Colorado, for example, it wasn't unusual for our supervisor, the poll worker that was going to be the supervisor over that voting site, to be in training for up to 8 hours a day over a 4-day period. And then depending on the jobs that were supporting that person, they may be, you know, a day or two less than that. But certainly 2 hours isn't enough. I think within that, we see a lot of benefit to having hands-on training, to having opportunity not just to be spoken to, but to have dialogue to ensure that learning is taking place. And if your state or jurisdiction doesn't allow that, or you don't have the resources for that, then really thinking about the job aids that you provide. When things are busy, when a lot of people are standing in line and they want to vote and that tension is there, most of those poll workers will never go back to that massive training manual. So any sort of quick reference guides, checklists, other job aids that can help them quickly ensure that the thing that they're doing, whether it's checking a voter in or issuing a ballot or ensuring those ballots get scanned or put in a ballot box accurately, it happens correctly, those job aids can make a big difference. And I think we've made some leaps forward in that. Those of you not familiar with the Center for Civic Design, they do a lot of work in this area. They've got a great, it's a poll worker manual toolkit. It's on the website. If you go to the U.S. Alliance for Election Excellence, Google that, you can find that toolkit, but it has a lot of those design best practices built in.
So you've seen a lot of the ways that states do things not as well, that, you know, there are best practices that some states are using and you're trying to convince states to adopt more of those. Given all of that, are you optimistic about our elections, or do you see a lot of doom and gloom that we seem to hear so much about in the media?
I'm so optimistic, actually. We do have some challenges when it comes to information, but since the designation of elections as critical infrastructure in 2017, we've actually seen tremendous progress across the country in making elections secure and resilient. And that gives me a lot of optimism. We see more states performing post-election audits. There are now only a couple of states that don't do that. We see more offices opening up their doors to allow the public and the media to come in and ask questions and learn how the equipment and the related processes work. We see local election officials doing really great proactive communication and putting out good materials. We see civic groups and academic institutions like your own, community leaders, others really trying to amplify that message of trust. We see more coordination with local law enforcement. We're starting to see joint training exercises happening with them. You know, we don't have all the federal funding and money that we need, but we've seen some of that and more of that, especially when it comes to physical security. So installing things like bulletproof glass or modifying office space to better protect officials and their staff while allowing for meaningful observation. That's been a huge positive. We see, we talked about the state associations. We're seeing a lot of help and support coming out of those organizations and really just sort of increased collaboration with other state and county partners, with our federal partners. I could go on and on, but I think it's easy to look at the downside if you're just focused on the news. We think about all the things that have happened even just since 2020. We're in a really good place. We're in probably a better place than we've ever been. So the community is just amazing.
That's great to hear. All right, final question for you. Why should people vote?
Wow. Great question. Tough question. Voting is such a powerful tool for influencing government actions. I'm sure that's can be debated, I guess, about how effective that is. But we know that it's foundational to democratic societies. And I think in addition to shaping public policy, voting is one way that we can hold our elected officials accountable. And I think we don't talk about that enough. We talk about the people that we want to vote into office and the changes we want to make. But we want elected representatives that are effective and ethical. And voting someone out of office can be just as impactful or just as important as the work we do to vote them in. I think also, you know, we're dealing with this question of trust and legitimacy, and certainly higher voter turnout helps ensure that government is acting in a way that represents the will of a majority of its citizens. And that really lends to the legitimacy of voting and elections.
Jennifer Morrell is the CEO and co-founder of the Elections Group, which supports election officials in the vital tasks they do to make sure our elections run smoothly. Jennifer, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much for having me.
Josh, some states conduct virtually all of their voting via the mail. Many other states have a significant number of absentee voters. So a big task of election workers is to verify those mail-in ballots. So what happens when election officials see a problem on the ballot envelope, a voter's signature doesn't seem to match the one on file, or they forgot to put their voter ID information or a date? What happens when these and other glitches are caught?
Well, in some places, the voters are out of luck. The election officials must toss their ballots. But over half of the states have a ballot curing process. Here's how it works. When the local election officials process a ballot and notice a problem, they will contact the voter either by phone or mail, though Colorado has implemented a texting system. There are even reports of local election officials trying to contact voters through their public social media profiles to let them know of the problem. Voters in many states can also track their ballots through the system, just like you would track a package that you're expecting to receive. The election officials will notify the voter of the problem and explain how to cure it. Some states set a ballot cure deadline of election day, so there might not be enough time left. Other states give voters a few days after election day to cure a ballot. Voters might have to submit a new ballot or send in an affidavit with the required information. Of course, these ballots are also checked to ensure there's no fraud in the system, meaning that the ballot curing process actually helps improve election integrity as well. Studies show that younger voters and voters of color are disproportionately more likely to have a ballot rejected, so the curing process can help to enhance equality. Not surprisingly, states with a ballot cure process have a much lower rate of rejected ballots. About 30 states in total have a curing process, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, and as it's a recognized best practice, perhaps the other states should join in.
The landslide election is an election official's prayer. Close elections mean long, tedious hours, but close elections certainly do happen. What are some good examples of close races?
Yeah, it's true. The election officials always say, please let this be a landslide, because close elections can mean recounts and further scrutiny. But of course, there have been several close elections in recent memory. There's Bush v. Gore in 2000, which came down to 537 votes in Florida. Although the U.S. Supreme Court stopped the recount in December 2000, allowing Florida to certify Bush as the winner of the state's electoral votes and therefore the presidency, a group of journalists examined all of the disputed ballots in that election to figure out who really won. Their answer? It depends. Based on only the set of ballots Gore asked to be examined, it's likely Bush would have remained on top. But looking at all ballots, Gore probably had the most votes. The answer is, we really don't know who really won Florida in 2000, although, of course, Bush was the certified winner. 4 years later, there was an extremely close race for governor of Washington, with a margin of only 129 votes out of 2.6 million cast. 2008 saw a disputed election in Minnesota for U.S. Senate between Norm Coleman and Al Franken that took months to resolve, with Franken ultimately winning by just 312 votes. And those are just the statewide races. that are often local races that come down to a vote or two. You just never know when your vote can make a difference. By the way, the 2020 election, by contrast, was not close, despite what Donald Trump might claim. He lost decisively in the Electoral College, much like he won decisively in the Electoral College in 2016. Because of the reality of very close elections and the impossibility sometimes of knowing the true winner, my friend and co-author Mike Pitts, a law professor, has suggested another idea. Just flip a coin if the margin is really, really close. Those elections are essentially statistical ties anyway. And somewhat tongue-in-cheek, he suggests that we use the one set of people that the American public truly trusts to flip a coin, NFL referees.
So what do you recommend as a really good resource for a voter who wants to dig deeper, take a deeper dive into this business of elections?
Yeah, the one thing that we can do to support democracy, I think check out the resources page on the Election Group's website. It's electionsgroup.com/resources. It is consistently updated with new content, broken down into categories including accelerating excellence, communications, election audits, election management, operations, polling places and poll workers, and security. Within each of these categories, resources include templates, articles, guides, and workbooks.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU. Educate myself on the fight.